What is the future of search? The answers to this question and more on this week's Radio Berkman. What does it mean exactly to search the web? It's not exactly like searching under your bed, even though the more digitally addicted of us may be guilty of stifling the instinct to Google our keys when they're missing. But on the web, usually what we're trying to find is meaningful, real-world information in the form of sensory input, language, images, or sounds. If that sounds a little overwhelming, bear with us. The way we've gotten to real-world information over time has changed. A search for the GDP of France a couple decades ago might have involved scanning the index of a world almanac, or before that, a trip to the local library's card catalog. Sounds exhausting. Today, if you typed GDP of France into your little search bar, you would expect to get a list of websites linking to the data. A Wikipedia article on the French economy, an article from the CIA's World Factbook, and a few million others that might or might not contain exactly what you're looking for. Well, some entrepreneurs in the field of search want us to see past the list of links and let us jump straight to the information. A quest to find the GDP of France in the search engine of tomorrow could direct you straight to a page filled with customized charts, tables, and maps displaying the GDP of France over time in various currencies per capita by region compared with other countries, any way you could possibly want it. And that could quite literally happen tomorrow. The first big attempt at combining a farmer's almanac, a scientific calculator, a research library, and a smart search engine, called Wolfram Alpha, is set to be unleashed on the web later this May. In public and private previews, the engine has wowed many, not just with its wealth of knowledge, but with its ability to take the words you type in the little search bar, understand what it is you're probably looking for, and display it in a way you can understand. Stephen Wolfram, the brains behind the engine, isn't new to blowing people's minds with revolutionary projects. In 1988, he released a software called Mathematica that made manipulating and visualizing equations and data a simple desktop activity. And in 2002, he released A New Kind of Science, a 1,280-page tome that employed computational systems in describing the universe. By combining the technology behind Mathematica with the concept behind A New Kind of Science, Wolfram Alpha may catch lightning in a bottle a third time for Stephen. Shortly after a public preview at Harvard University last week, Stephen sat down with David Weinberger to discuss what Wolfram Alpha does and how it may change the way we search.
Our kind of best three-word description is it's a computational knowledge engine. So its purpose is to take the knowledge that has been accumulated and those parts of it that can be computed with, to be able to compute with them and to be able to generate answers to specific questions using the sort of corpus of existing knowledge, using the data, the methods, the models, and so on that have been accumulated, put them in computational form and be able to answer sort of any specific question where the answer can be computed.
What are prototypical questions that you have in mind for this?
So there can be sort of pure formal questions that are like mathematical questions, like what's the integral of this or that. There can be questions about the world, like, you know, what's the population of such and such a country? What was the weather like on a particular day in a particular place? There can be things that sort of combine some pure data with computation, like, for example, you know, what will the tide be on a particular day at a particular place, where you have to know some geographical data, some historical information about tides, and then you have to compute the physics of the tides to work out what will happen. And there are things which are both where the answers are both numbers and quantitative kinds of things, and where the answers are more kind of textual or symbolic.
The answers that the site gives are not simple one-word answers or numbers. They give that too, but you are including a range of types of information that somebody might want.
Right. So the idea is, what would an expert do if you asked them this question? What would they actually tell you? Would they just tell you one answer? Would they give you kind of some background? Would they give you some related answers? Kind of the idea is to generate a report that sort of gives you both, that gives you sort of all versions of what you might immediately want to know about a particular thing. So that will be typically some graphical presentations, some tables of data, some synthesized text, these kinds of things. It's sort of a big challenge is to sort of do this kind of automated presentation where you try and take out of, in some cases there might be a huge amount of stuff that you could compute. The problem is to sort of pick out those things that will be most kind of immediately cognitively useful to the person who asked that question. We also have a sidebar where we intend to put sort of related links to things that people might find useful given the particular questions that they're asking. And often those links will be to things that are complementary to the kind of sort of direct factual material that we're giving. Things that, for example, are linking out to, I don't know, Wikipedia or something where there's some narrative description of some particular topic that kind of complements the just the facts kind of results that we're giving them all from Alpha.
So how does it work? I mean, it's pretty right. Impressive.
So in terms of sort of the foundations, you know, one of them is Mathematica, and the other is my NKS new kind of science direction. Mathematica is sort of the underlying infrastructure, the language, the platform on which the site is built. It's quite big. It's 5 or 6 million lines of Mathematica code, and Mathematica, in most measurements one can make, is perhaps 10, maybe 20 times more succinct as a programming language than a typical kind of, you know, C, Java type programming language. So that's a lot of code.
So Mathematica enables you to do mathematical computation, but also symbolic logical computation as well.
You know, what Mathematica provides for us is kind of a uniform way of representing knowledge in symbolic form and applying, and we already have in Mathematica a zillion algorithms for operating on that kind of symbolic representation, whether it's in a kind of purely mathematical way, whether it's in a sort of proving theorems in some logical way, whether it's representing things graphically in some way, these kinds of things. So that's kind of the technical platform that makes Wolfram Alpha, I think, conceivable. From a conceptual point of view, I think it's sort of the NKS new kind of science thing that makes Wolfram Alpha kind of conceivable. I've kind of wondered, you know, Wolfram Alpha is kind of the third big project I've tried to do in my life. Mathematica, NKS, the other two. I kind of have this meta theory that most people have at most one big idea in their lives, right? So if I've got three big projects, they're really all the same idea, and they're really all about kind of taking a sort of a rich set of things that one is interested in dealing with and understanding what are the sort of underlying primitives from which one can build up all those things, whether it's in the computer language of Mathematica, having the sort of computational primitives that let one build up programs, whether it's in the case of NKS, asking if we look at the world, the universe as it is, what are the kind of underlying primitives, what are the computational, the simple programs that can potentially drive all of this stuff. And Wolfram Alpha, it's sort of the realization that all this knowledge that's out there in the world, that there is a feasibly small sort of set of frameworks and algorithms and computations from which one can move out to deal with all of these different kinds of things. But for me, this idea that there really are, for the world at large, these kind of small programs that are capable of being rich enough in their behavior to sort of capture a lot of what goes on in the world. The idea that there are these small programs is the thing that sort of, from a paradigmatic point of view, makes it to me conceivable that one can do something like Wolfram Alpha and that it isn't just too big. And, you know, that one doesn't just have to say, you know, in sort of the traditional kind of science, one might say, it's just too big. The only way to do this is to have a billion people work on it. There just can't be sort of underlying sort of fairly small programmatic principles that let one build this kind of thing up. As I say, my meta theory is people have at most one big idea. So all these things are connected, and exactly how kind of NKS, the paradigm of NKS flows into Wolfram Alpha, I know some part of it. There's probably more to that flow than I yet know.
In fact, I'm very interested in the relation of NKS, of new kind of science, and Wolfram Alpha. Can you give an example, maybe, of where NKS thinking shows up in the development of?
Right. So I mean, for example, in a very straightforward thing is linguistic analysis of inputs. It might seem that it's just too messy, too complicated, there's too many possibilities. The fact is that what we end up with are these fairly small, simple rules that we often deduce from looking at some giant corpus of information from the web and giant collection of ways that people say things. We try and abstract these fairly simple rules, and then we have to ask ourselves, you know, so what consequences do these rules have? And, you know, if you look at the folks who are developing the linguistic analysis parts of WolfMalthus, when you actually look at, you know, work that's being done, there are these images, these graphics that show up on the screen that look awfully like kind of evolution of cellular automata or some such other thing. There are all these blobs of color and so on that represent, in this case, you know, various pieces of potential linguistic analysis for phrases or whatever else it is. But it's very much a sort of an NKS approach of you take these fairly small underlying programs and you say, what did this build up into, and does this successfully manage to correspond to something that is useful for sort of doing linguistic analysis? I mean, in general, in developing Wolfram Alpha, and actually also a lot in developing Mathematica these days, the algorithms that we have were not engineered by people. They're things that were essentially found in the computational universe of possible algorithms. I mean, it's kind of like, I view it as being kind of like an algorithmic version of mining. I mean, when we deal with sort of standard engineering technology, you know, we're used to going out into the world and going and finding, you know, the iron ore and, putting it together and making something, you know, making a steel thing out of it or something like that. Now what NKS sort of suggests is that out in the computational universe of possible programs, there's lots of interesting, quite small programs that exist. And the question is, can we go as humans and find programs that are useful to mine from that collection of possible programs, that are useful to mine for the particular technological purposes that we have? And that's something we've ended up doing a lot of. I mean, a lot of the pieces of code that exist in Mathematica, in Wolfram Alpha, are things that were sort of just found in the computational universe and turn out to be really useful, in the same way that people, you know, found that, you know, magnetite was really useful, or liquid crystals were really useful in the material world.
So we have Mathematica, we've got NKS, and there are other components to Wolfram Alpha.
Right.
There's data, for example. You know,
right.
Small
so
part
I think the way I see the system from a sort of technology point of view, there are really kind of four pillars of the technology that we built. The first of them is kind of curated data. So, you know, we've got a lot of data that we've organized, correlated, cleaned up, made computable, not just static data, but also data that's kind of flowing in from all sorts of feeds and all this kind of thing. We've kind of built this sort of industrial pipeline for curating data where, you know, we put a lot of effort into identifying the right sources, we get the data in, we have a lot of automation in kind of trying to find correlations, anomalies, and so on in the data. Then we feed it to actual sort of human data curators, and we sort of expose it to domain experts, because one thing I've discovered is that if there isn't a domain expert somewhere in the pipeline, you're going to get the wrong answer. Then, you know, the goal is to take sort of raw data from the outside and get it to the point where it's really consistent and computable with. So that's kind of the first component, is kind of this curated data component. Another component is the kind of the computational algorithms that go inside. You know, there's the question of taking the fruits of science and engineering and, you know, all sorts of forms of analysis and encoding them in a computational form so that we can actually use them when people need to use them, apply them to the data that we have, and so on. And that's been a big effort of kind of just seeing just what is, and just what has science and so on achieved, and how do we make it computational. And this is just big Mathematica programs, 5 or 6 million lines of Mathematica code now, that encode sort of the things that one can compute about the world based on science and so on. So that's kind of the second component of Wolfram Alpha. The third component is sort of the linguistic analysis component of how do we take these funny utterances that humans will feed to Wolfram Alpha and try and understand what can we compute from that. And in a sense, that was a part of, I mean, every part of this project seemed to me like it might be impossible. This is one of the ones where I had sort of an argument from history that this part would be impossible, which is that people have been trying to do natural language understanding for a really long time, and its successes are not that widespread. But what I realized at some key moment was, What we're trying to do is kind of the opposite of what people have mostly been trying to do. What people have mostly been trying to do is they've thrown thousands or millions of pages of sort of perfectly formed linguistic texts, and they ask their computers, okay, go understand all this narrative, go read these books and tell me what they're about, kind of thing. Computers have found it really hard to do that. Our problem is kind of the opposite. There's a certain set of things that we know how to compute things with and that we represent in this sort of symbolic form. And if we can figure out, if we can get something that is in that symbolic form, then we're off and running. So really the question is, can we take these sort of human utterances and map them to these symbolic forms that we happen to know about? Then we can go off and actually do our thing and compute things with them. So it's sort of the opposite from the traditional natural language understanding problem. And it's something where I was not sure whether we would sort of be squashed by the ambiguities and vicissitudes of language. It's turned out to be surprisingly that all these different notations and pieces of kind of compact representation that people use as specialists in particular areas don't overlap as much as I thought they did. And kind of a good test now, sometimes we'll see these things which we can't deal with, and I'll show them to a bunch of people, and no person will be able to figure out what on earth this was about. And one of the things we realize is, you know, there may be some perfect kind of almost mathematical theory of how language should be specified, but it sort of can't work. Because as we're putting on all these different kinds of specialist notations, if every one was arbitrarily extended in a perfect way, they will inevitably collide with each other. And so we only get to, you know, if we can just do the part that humans can understand, that's really what we need to do, because it's going to be humans who are going to be entering in this sort of, at least this interface to Wolf-Malfer, it's humans who are doing the entering of things. So anyway, the sort of third component is this linguistic analysis component and being able to deal with kind of free-form linguistic input. Fourth component is really how you present the results, because sometimes there's just a zillion things you can compute about something. And there's the question of which actual results do we present so that it is kind of cognitively useful to the human who's reading it. And there's sort of a collection of expert knowledge, heuristics, algorithms, the sort of thing that we call computational aesthetics, which is the kind of the question of, you know, when you're going to present some piece of data in graphical form, what's the kind of way to do that is most likely to be accessible to a person? So this is kind of the fourth component, is this kind of automated presentation component that is important. And, you know, one of the things I realized about the system as we built it is, we couldn't really shirk on any one of these four things. We can't, we need a lot of actual curated data. Otherwise, there's no kind of raw material to do anything with. We need to be able to compute with it. It's no good to just say, look up the data, because the chance that somebody just wants to look up the particular thing that you put in is not going to be very great. We need to actually be able to compute from that. We need to have a way for people to interact with the system. You know, we need to be able to, we're not going to expect them to read the Mathematica documentation now, even just for Mathematica, it's 10,000 pages. For Wolf-Malfer, you know, we're not going to expect people to read the whole encyclopedia in order to be able to interact with us. So sort of the only choice is to have a zero documentation approach where we're just dealing with sort of pure sort of language as people would produce it. And then finally, the presentation of information, we can generate all sorts of wonderful stuff, but if we can't present it in a form that people can absorb, that's also not useful. So we kind of need all these four components to actually build a system that that can be useful.
You could actually take one of the components, the data component, and if you wanted to, split it in two. There's a component of that could conceivably be counted as important, which is the metadata, the decision about which information about the information you're going to capture. This metadata, which at least much of it is apparently in the form of ontologies, of connected concepts, may have its own value.
When you're going to describe a kind of thing, there's a question of sort of what are the pieces of that description? So you have, you know, there's the notion of a country, there's the notion of a country has certain properties, there's certain attributes, like what date were you talking about this country at. There's questions about, are there groups of countries that are kind of, classes that from which, countries in NATO or something like that, or countries in South America. These are all kind of part of this sort of ontological structure of the knowledge about countries. And for us, we have a pretty definite representation of that kind of knowledge about countries. We need that because otherwise we can't have it sort of operate with other kinds of information. We need to be able to have, this is part of making Wolfram Alpha a sort of a manageable thing, is that there are kind of global frameworks that operate across a bunch of different domains. And for that, we need sort of an organized ontology of things. One of the big challenges with ontologies is you have an ontology about countries. How does it relate to the ontology about cities? How does it relate to the ontology about this, that, and the other, right? So, we were approaching this from a very kind of practical engineering point of view. We're just building ontologies across hundreds of domains. But we realized that there were important ways to have these ontologies communicate with each other, that one of them was actually a very sort of science-oriented way, which is units of measure of things. So there's or physical quantities that things represent. So, for instance, if you have two things that both have units of volume, there's a reasonable chance that these things are somehow related to each other. Not always. There can be a thing where I'm not sure I can generate it for length cubed in particular, but it's quite commonly the case that for something which has sort of the same physical dimensions, there may be three or four different kinds of concepts that that relates to. And so, for example, a length could be a depth, it could be an altitude, it could be a height. These are related concepts, and often they can be dealt with in a sort of in an interoperable kind of way. You can divide two of these things and it's meaningful. You can perhaps add them and it's meaningful. But then there are some other kinds of purposes for which you can't combine them, and for which you might want to give some different related information and so on. So it gets quite subtle, but we have kind of a reasonable, pragmatic way, at least, to deal with things like properties that have that are related and that can be combined in particular ways, these types of things. It'd be great if there was just a grand theory of all this stuff, if we could just start from scratch and just sort of say, top down, let's just describe the ontology of the world, and let's just then build a system based on the ontology of the world that we've thereby described. That isn't what we did. And despite my great predilection for grand theories of things, that seems really hard and in some sense not useful, because what we're dealing with is sort of human accessible knowledge. And here I might get a little philosophical on things, but there's sort of the question of what knowledge is possible and what knowledge is kind of human related. So for instance, from NKS, we've learnt that sort of in the computational universe of possible programs, there's lots of stuff out there. We as humans have only explored some tiny corners of this. For example, in our mathematics, it is the case that you could invent the particular mathematics that we've pursued as grown from some particular axiom systems and so on. But we could just say, let's throw it open. Let's look at the space of all possible axiom systems. Gazillions of possible axiom systems, of which the mathematics that we pursued is only 10 of them, for example. But there are gazillions of others. And they all have their properties and they all have particular features. The stuff that is sort of human, has humanly been accessed, is only this tiny corner, these 10 axiom systems that we kind of grandfathered through from the Babylonians on. What happens when we look at all the other ones? What happens at all this knowledge that hasn't been sort of humanly accessed knowledge? A lot of it is knowledge you just can't get in any kind of quick way. That is, you go right into computational irreducibility and undecidability and so on. There's lots that you can't compute about the world. There's a certain amount that you can compute that is sort of the parts that have formed the science that we've developed and traditionally as humans, the mathematics we've developed, things like that. There's also a lot out there that is not accessible in that way. If you fall off the parts that are computationally reducible, the parts for which kind of theoretical science works well, if you fall off those parts, and there's a lot away from those parts, you just can't compute that much. You kind of just have to follow simulations to see what will happen and things. You can't quickly work out what will happen. Okay, there's a second problem, which is you can't linguistically describe what you're talking about. We you know, as humans, we've developed a certain language. The concepts that we've put into our languages are the concepts that we have done a lot with, that we sort of become familiar with. Those are the things that we tend to give words to. And so one of the other limitations, in a sense, is sort of at a philosophical level, a limitation is that Wolfram Alpha, its interface is linguistic. The things that one can easily describe to it are things for which there is human language. There's a lot else out there that is sort of both very hard to compute with and for which there isn't sort of a human linguistic representation that's convenient. I mean, when you see a picture of a cellular automaton evolution and somebody says, quick, describe it, you know, we don't have words to describe these things. It's a long, you know, you'd be writing, you basically eventually just be saying, well, just look at the picture, you know, you see what it looks like.
That. That's
yes,
my description.
Right. I mean, so this idea of computational irreducibility, the idea that there's lots of sophisticated computation that goes on in the world and nature that makes sort of the complexity of nature, it's the flip side of that fact that makes Wolfram Alpha possible, by which I mean that there's, in a sense, comparatively little about which we can talk linguistically or about which we can compute. In the space of all possible things, there's only this sort of small corner, and that means that when we get to sort of linguistically talk about things, because there's only the small corner we can talk about, it is feasible to actually understand this broad range of language, because it can only talk about the small corner of things. If we were able to talk about everything, it would be much harder to understand with a short description what we could possibly be talking about.
So if I were to ask Wolfram Alpha a question that I think it's not designed for, such as how many people in the U.S. have been tortured?
Right.
Or give me a list of world religions.
Okay.
Which is a very straightforward sort of question. The first question obviously is politically loaded. The second one is a very straightforward sort of question.
Right.
Will Scientology show up on it?
Good question.
And more important, what's the decision process?
Right. So,
what do you do with that inevitable decision?
So I mean, you know, what we're trying to do, so in this phase of the project, what we've done is to take sort of generally reliable public sources of data, so to speak, and try and make them computable. We're not going out and individually surveying people and saying, you know, what do you think, you know, what is your religion or something like that. So, you know, this question of in the case of, for example, religions, you know, we've been agonizing about this particular one, and there was a big push on the part of some people on the project that we just shouldn't put this in because it's too much of a mess, right? But then other people pointed out, look, it's more useful to have something than to have nothing. I mean, it is useful to know, you know, roughly how many, you know, Christians are there in the world or something, or are there in, you know, in South America or something like that. That's useful information. Now, even if it's slightly wrong, because there might be different definitions and, you know, do you count, you know, how many animists are there in America or something, right? Our decision procedure is probably similar to the decision procedure of folks who've tried to put together encyclopedias or any other kind of authoritative reference work. You know, we try and do the best we can. We talk to experts. In our case, we get, you know, we have a couple of constraints. We want to have something. Eventually, we're going to want to have a definite number for something. Even though we may annotate it with a footnote, at some level, we're going to have to make a decision. There is a definite number for this thing. So in the case of religions, you know, you can look, I don't know, the CIA fact book will have, you know, something, some data on that. There are particular organizations that collect data on that kind of thing. I don't know in the particular case of that example, I know that something we're actually actively trying to unscramble right now. With luck, those different sources will vaguely, at least close to agree, at least to the first or second decimal place they'll agree. You know, the first or second significant figure will agree.
But people will use these numbers from your site. To the extent to which your site becomes the place where you go to get the answer that the experts would have given you, to the extent to which it succeeds, is going to be used in these debates. Does it concern you that some of the answers, at least, are in fact based upon good decisions, but decisions nonetheless about what constitutes good data and how to categorize that data?
Right, so we sort of have three escape valves for this issue, okay? The first thing is you type your input, and we'll typically give what we call the input interpretation. The first part of output will be the input interpretation, okay? So if you say something like, you know, how much do school teachers get paid, right? It's a complicated question, right? The input interpretation will probably say, you know, I don't know what, school teachers, including this and that and the other, excluding this, median wage, okay? So we're saying what question we're actually answering. That might be, we hope, is close to and a useful variant of the question you asked, but it may not be. You know, you will have asked some question where you might have had something different in mind. You might have had the minimum wage or the maximum wage or something else. Now, typically in our sort of report that we generate, we will give what we know about, you know, the range of wages or some such other thing. But when we have to compute from it, if you say, you know, how much do teachers get paid divided by doctors, okay? You know, by the time you're doing that, we'll give a definite answer for the ratio of the median wages, and then we may give a bunch of additional information about sort of the data that went into it. So sort of first, in a sense, escape valve, first place where we get to sort of put things through a more precise filter is we have this input interpretation that says this is what we're actually dealing with. Okay. So another thing is that when we give answers, we try to give kind of pithy footnotes that give an indication of what it is we're actually assuming. I mean, you know, a typical example is, I don't know, some health kind of thing where, you know, there'll be a classification for your overweight, for instance, okay? Now, that's, to many people, that's a value judgment, right? To some other people, it's a precise medical distinction, right? What we're dealing with is more the precise medical distinction than the value judgment. And so, you know, we'll put a little, you know, try to make a pithy footnote because we know people, you know, if we put a giant essay there, nobody's going to read it. You know, it sort of says, I don't remember that particular one, but it'll say, you know, based on, you know, CDC or WHO, you know, guidelines or some such other thing. So that's kind of the, that's how we try to deal with these things where there's a distinction that's been made and it's sort of, you know, we try to go with whatever the standards body has said and then say what the standards body is. And then the final thing that we get to do is we sometimes get to put up a thing saying, assuming you mean blah, you know, then we give a bunch of results and use blah instead, right? And so that's another place where we get to, you know, if there's sort of a very controversial thing is, you know, there are these funny cases where, well, we just had one recently that was sort of horrifying, was the pets versus food problem. You know, the issue is, if you type in rabbit, what do you get? Okay? And for reasons of bad sort of linguistic prioritization, one was getting nutrition content. In the US, this is very upsetting to people, right? And, you know, in other countries, it's a different story. You know, so that's a case where we get to use GRIP information and we will make the decision in the US, you know, a rabbit is a, you know, an animal with these characteristics. You know, I don't know in the case of rabbits in particular, but let's assume that they're a very popular food in some other country and are not usually kept as pets there. Then the GRIP in that country will cause us to flip around that assumption.
Site? It's open to everybody to use. It's a free site. But the data and the metadata and the algorithms are... seem to be quite valuable. Other people could make use of it. What are the plans for making this and for opening this site up?
Well, so the first thing is that there's going to be an API for people to have different sort of kinds of access to the site, both.
So another computer program can call yours and get results back.
Right. Or it could be another website that is including some pods of output from Wolfram Alpha on that site, providing some input field with some specialized input field that can go and use the Wolfram Alpha engine and get results back. Or it could be some, you know, desktop application program that is making calls to Wolfram Alpha. The thing that thing one realizes is, you know, it's a living, breathing thing. It's not very easy to take pieces of it and just say to people, you know, here's a big piece, you know, go do something useful with it. Because, for example, let's take the data. The data changes, you know, all the time. The data is changing. It's changing. Some data is changing very rapidly on timescales of order seconds. Some data is changing on timescales of order months. It's not the case. We can't just say sort of dump the data out. The data is the seed for an algorithm.
It's also frequently data that is proprietary and you've licensed.
Yes, that's right.
So another reason you can't simply dump it out.
Right. And I think that the idea is that we will provide a resource that for anybody who wants to use what we have, we will provide a good way for them as humans to use it or as humans using programs to have their programs use it. And sort of the idea is to provide an efficient, you know, well-kept up, sort of an industrially strong kind of thing that people can go to get what they need from this. Now, you know, we certainly are aware of the fact that there are computations that the people will want to do that will run longer than the site could possibly run them for. One of the things that I think we'll see happening is that there'll be things where there's sort of the Wolfram Alpha kind of central store of data, computational elements and so on, and then there's the sort of the thick client for it, which is the Mathematica that's able to take sort of pieces of what's coming from Wolfram Alpha and run that stuff locally. So this is sort of a way of sort of opening out and enabling more people to kind of get access to sort of the capabilities that we're providing.
The ontologies or schema or whatever you want to call them, those themselves, the fact that you have a way of representing, say, a nation and multiple other domains, that's something that people working on the semantic web are working quite hard at doing. Is that, you're going to make that available as well?
Probably. I mean, I think that will... So one thing we hope to do is to have a nice, organized, almost formalized process for people to contribute data to our data repository. And in order to make that possible, we kind of have to say, how is this data going to be structured? And so, you know, I think we'll probably have quite an effort in, for particular domains, in sort of exposing some of the structure that we've already built, and possibly people will propose other pieces of structure that need to get added on to that. So I think that will get exposed, and you know, if there's good traffic in data being provided for sort of access by people in Wolfram Alpha, if there's good traffic to that, I suspect that the ontology that we have will sort of become kind of a useful standard for other people who are kind of doing things with where they're trying to sort of fit semantic data together.
A useful free standard, a useful open standard. Either of those two?
Well, gee, I'm not sure I've thought through all of these. My guess is that we will want it to be an open standard. From our point of view, the more data that exists in the world that is structured in a way that, particularly a way that we can easily deal with, the better everybody is, and the better we are too. Our objective is to make, you know, this good sort of definitive sort of place to go to get computational knowledge. And there are many components to that. I mean, the data is just one component. You know, if more of the world would help in assembling the data, that would be great. I mean, we hire lots of data curators, right? And they do a great job. And we hope that there will be quite a community of sort of volunteer data curators, and we'll provide sort of tools for volunteer data curators. You know, I'll be very interested to see what happens. I mean, you know, Wikipedia has been a fantastic success story of kind of the things assembled by crowd, so to speak. But I have this feeling, when you see an essay in Wikipedia, the very texture of that essay sort of tells you what's going on. It tells you whether the person knows what they're talking about. It tells you, you know, whether they're, you know, it just gives you some feeling for what's going on. Data is, in a sense, very cold. You know, it's just 7.2. You know, the number is 7.2. It doesn't come with attached to an essay. It's just 7.2. And, you know, what you need, the kind of reliability that you need, and the kind of people who are going to make that number 7.2 as opposed to 7.8, it's important to have a kind of a somewhat more controlled environment, because you don't get to know all of the footnotes, so to speak, immediately, as you do in kind of the essay type setting. So, I mean, right now, my best mechanism is you hire good data curators. We have all these tests for data curators. You know, we hire good people. They have to have quite a bit of domain knowledge, otherwise they get things wrong. And you know, it's a somewhat more sort of organized and professionalized thing. Now, I'm certainly hoping that we will be able to provide the tools and the framework to have a very good community of volunteer and so on data curators out there who can potentially help with what we're doing, but we fully expect that what they're doing will have to sort of fit into this whole pipeline we've built, and sort of that we'll have to be doing our sort of data auditing processes and so on them. Right now, it doesn't feel like the kind of thing for which it's going to work to just say, okay, well, you know, everybody just put the piece you feel like in.
In the media, I've already seen Wolfram Alpha referred to as a Google killer. Who are you trying to kill? Anybody with this?
I don't want to. That's not what I do. I build
trying to
stuff.
Kill Wikipedia, trying to kill reference librarians.
No. The thing I like to do is I like to build stuff. You know, I build stuff as a practical person. It has to sort of fit into the ecosystem of the world. It has to be able to support itself, things like that. If we look at Google and Wikipedia, these are both sort of great achievements, and they're both very complementary to what we're doing. I mean, we're dealing with the facts, just the facts. Wikipedia is dealing with kind of the narrative, and you might have noticed the sidebar to Wolfram Alpha often pulls up Wikipedia links with little rollovers that show sort of some little piece of narrative from Wikipedia. That, I think, is a terrific kind of synergy there. And maybe we'll get other kinds of encyclopedic and other kinds of narrative things that can sort of complement Wolfram Alpha. As far as search is concerned, traditional web search, again, is a very complementary kind of thing. I mean, you know, I use Wolfram Alpha lots. I also use, you know, search engines and Google and so on lots. I'll use, you know, a search engine where I'm looking for some fragmentary piece of information that isn't systematic at all, that's just, you know, well, is there something about, you know, David Weinberger and, you know, that just happens to be out there that I can kind of pick up and read the narrative about it. Perhaps I'm a business idealist, okay? You know, I've been lucky enough to have a successful business for 20-something years, that I've been able to sort of pursue with Mathematica and so on something that I consider to be kind of intellectually there's something of sort of high intellectual integrity that also can be a very pleasantly successful business. You know, I certainly hope to do the same kind of thing with Wolfram Alpha, and I think that the I'm sort of hoping for the best possible synergy with folks who have complementary kinds of things. I mean, I hope we won't be killing anybody. I hope nobody will be trying to kill us, so to speak. I think we're doing something that I believe can lead to a lot of sort of positive progress in the world, and I'm just keen to see that happen.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Stephen Wolfram is the brains behind Mathematica, a new kind of science, and the soon-to-be-launched Wolfram Alpha Knowledge Engine. You may want to bookmark the site at www.wolframalpha.com. You can find more information than you can imagine at our own humble knowledge engine, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. There you'll find links to David and Stephen's uncut full one-hour conversation and to a video demo of Wolfram Alpha. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University.